Welcome, this is your host, Zaida Sorel Medina with The Voice Podcast. Welcome to The Voice Podcast. This is your host, Zaida. If you are new, I want to let you know, welcome to The Voice. If you're returning, welcome back. I really appreciate my listeners because y'all are the ones that keep me going. If you have any comments or you want to hear me talk about something specific, do not hesitate to reach out to me at ZaidaSorrellMedina@gmail.com. I just love to tell stories, and I use this platform as a way to shed light on different urban and social work topics. I combine my personal background and my professional background to create meaningful content. I have a PhD in urban and environmental planning and policy and a master's degree in social work. In this season one, I explore how my minoritized identities, for example, as a woman of color, first-generation college student, and former foster and homeless youth reflect larger social and urban topics that manifest in diverse ways. Each episode builds on one another, and I conclude with educational takeaways that are relevant for educators, social workers, parents at Promise Youth, and the general audience. I would also like to invite you all to join my Facebook page, which is called The Voice Podcast. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and get started. So go ahead and sit back and relax, unless you're driving, because I don't want to be accountable for no accidents. Okay, here we go. I begin this episode with a reflection from the other day. A Spanish-speaking person asked me, "Where was I from? ¿De dónde tú eres?" This can mean many things. It can mean, what is my nationality? Where was I born? Where did I grow up? What is my race? But when people ask me this question in the context of me speaking Spanish, I presume it means, what is my Hispanic heritage, for which I tell them that I'm Cuban descent. And of course, those who speak Spanish tell me in response that I sound Puerto Rican. Pues yo no creo que tenga un acento boricua, pero bueno, mi mamá adoptada era boricua. My adopted mother, rest her soul in peace, was a proud Puerto Rican woman who left a strong imprint on my life. So if I have a Puerto Rican accent when I speak in Spanish, which I don't think I do, but you can be the judge of that, that's where it's coming from. In this episode, I reveal the beauty and the hiccups of being integrated into a non-conventional family. My biological mother ended up kicking me out for nearly the same thing that my aunt did a few years prior, for spending too much time in school. I remember the day like it was yesterday. It was a cold winter day in St. Louis, Missouri. I was coming home from wrestling practice. I could tell by my mother's greeting that hell was about to break loose. She wanted to know why I spent so much time in school. Why did I come home late every day? I told her that I had wrestling practice, and she said, "Well, can't the coach understand that I don't live in that neighborhood? Why can't they end practice early?" I was not acting my age. I was doing quote-unquote too much. Before I knew it, my brother jumped into the argument and threw in his two cents. He said, You better show your mama some respect. You're a rude child, a rude child. I sat there silently, listening to my mother and my brother yell at me. In my teenage mind, nothing made sense. This girl, Yetta said, reaching her boiling point. She came closer and knocked on my head twice. Are you there? She asked, and took a few steps backwards, staring at me. This girl isn't even listening. You see this, Andres? She hasn't even looked up once. Nope, not once. That's ignorant. Straight up ignorant, Andres said. My brother, who knew how to yell and scream, only knew how to yell and scream. Before I knew it, my mother was giving me the boot. Well, sugar, Yetta said, emitting a witch-like laugh. If you can't respect Andres, and you can't respect me, you got to leave. Yep, Andres agreed. My mother's unilateral decision to give me the boot was met with utter disbelief. In my teenage mind, my straight A's and well-roundedness should have led my mother to be proud of my overachievements. Conversely, my mother, with all of the worry inside of her, could only articulate more worry. The matter was a closed case. I had to go. No ifs, ands, and but. I thought to myself that if there was a God, he must have been on vacation. Where the hell was I supposed to go? It was dark outside in St. Louis and it was snowing. Didn't you hear me? Yetta said fiercely. Andres, Christopher, Ricardo, and Yetta, watch me scatter through my belongings. I grabbed my primary necessities. A toothbrush, underwear, my wrestling shoes. Some minutes later, I stormed out the door, out of the dim sky. The snow fell harshly, wetting my eyes, my hair, and my face. The wind blew from above, and the trees rustled vigorously. I ran past the weeded bushes, the snow-topped fields, and the decaying apartment buildings. The roads were silent. I continued to run swiftly into the night, panting hoarsely. My feet felt numb against my socks. And then I stopped running and looked up at the bus stop, topped with snow. I stood there and waited in the chill of the blistery Midwestern winter for a bus to come. When it came, I hopped on, even though I didn't know exactly where I was going. Luckily, I had a few quarters in my pocket to use the payphone. The only person I could think of calling was Esmeralda's mother, Marta. She was shocked to receive my phone call so late at night. Marta was even more shocked to know that my mom kicked me out. She said that I could come over. So she fixed me a hot cup of tea and gave me a set of pajamas and a pillow. We stayed up for hours talking about her life in Mexico, how much she missed her family, and how she wished Jose would stop his silliness. I love Marta and I wanted to live with her forever. But as much as I wanted the moment to last, I knew that staying with her was only temporary. Her house was small and she worked odd jobs, cleaning houses to make ends meet. I ended up asking if I could live with my former teacher, Norma, and she said yes. Norma lived right down the street from my high school. Her kitchen was filled with Puerto Rican recipe books, old and new, in English and Spanish. Her refrigerator was stocked with frozen strawberries, eggs, and veggie burgers. In her closet, in the kitchen, she had what appeared to be a year's supplies worth of biscuit mix. In the living room, she had all of her favorite music CDs, including Las Chicas del Can and Luis Vargas. I knew that my life with Norma would be less stressful. I lived in the school district in what appeared to be a safe Jewish neighborhood where other students walked to school. I could walk to school as if because it was a few blocks away. I immediately felt at home. It was just Norma and I in the house, and I had my own bedroom. And I knew that life with Norma was going to just be A-OK. One day, I woke up to Norma's sweet humming. "Good morning, Muñeca," she said to me as I walked past her bedroom. She fried eggs and zucchini for breakfast, gave me a ride to school, and for dinner she cooked steamed rice and vegetables. When the weekend arrived, Norma woke me up in early and asked if I wanted to go to Walmart with her. "We're going to Walmart," she said, "the white Walmart." "What's the white Walmart?" I asked her. "That's, a better Walmart. There is a black Walmart and there is a white Walmart," she explained. "The black one ain't got nothing. The white one, well, it's clean, has good service, and there's more stuff." We drove more than an hour to the white Walmart, where Norma perused each aisle, occasionally picking up an item, inspecting it, and putting it back down on a shelf. After inspecting what appeared to be the entire store, Norma finally settled on her usual item, raisin bread. But it wasn't just any raisin bread, nah. It was the best raisin bread that I had ever eaten. It was soft and moist. It melted right in your mouth. By the time we got home, Norma had already eaten the entire bag of the raisin bread. At home, she went to her bedroom and started studying Mandarin. If she wanted to go to China next year, she said, she had to brush up on her Chinese. Norma was always doing something. That's what I liked about her. "There was not enough hours in the day to do everything you love," she would say. "So you have to do what you love every single day." One day when I came home from school, three Chinese children were in the kitchen digging in their hands in a bowl of flour. They looked in my direction when they heard the door shut. The little boy, who must have been no older than 4 or 5 years old, pointed his fingers at me. "What was that, Norma?" he asked. Norma leaned over and saw me. "That's Seda," she said. "She's my other daughter." "You have two daughters, Norma?" the older girl asked. "I do," Norma said. I walked into the kitchen where Norma and the three children were forming balls with the flour and placing them into the pan. She introduced me to the other three children. Their names were Meili, Peter, and Christy. And they were her students at school where she taught. "We're making sugar cookies," she said. "They're the easiest cookies to make ever." I couldn't believe it. Norma referenced me as her other daughter. Suddenly, I felt a strong sense of belonging with Norma and what appeared to be my new Chinese siblings in the making. Before the start of winter break, I came up with a marvelous idea to host a dinner party for my fellow classmates in the Gay Straight Alliance Club at school, including my besties Luna and Marisa. When I pitched the idea to Norma, she said, of course. She would have to clean off the dining room table, but that wouldn't be a problem, she said. She would cook vegetarian turkey, some vegetables, cookies, and apple cider. On the evening of the dinner party, I arrived a few minutes late because I attended wrestling practice. When I arrived, everyone was already there, and Norma was upstairs entertaining them. The smell of savory vegetarian turkey filled the air. The dining room table was dressed elegantly with cloth napkins and placemats. When I entered, Norma smiled at me and said, "There she is." She tapped the bed, signaling for me to join them. The evening passed pleasantly. When it was time to eat, Norma called everyone to the dining room table. Before we began eating, she stood at the head of the table to give her grand announcement. "Before you stuff your faces, let me tell you what's on the menu. There's vegetarian turkey, bread rolls, cranberry sauce, this is the eggplant parmesan, and first dessert, fruit and strawberry shortcake." One of the girls from the club picked up her cup of tea and said softly as she drank from her cup, "You have the coolest mom, Z." I smiled at her, and underneath the table, my toes curled. I didn't know how to exactly respond because Norma wasn't my real mother, or was she? But what exactly was a real mother? She sort of informally adopted me, so in my mind, she was my mother, irrespective of blood and legal relations. At school, I told people that Norma was my mother. This was easier to say rather than having to explain to people that I was staying with her temporarily because I was homeless. And then people would be curious to know why I'm homeless. And then before you knew it, my entire life story would be the topic of conversation by merely revealing that Norma was not my so-called real mama. So rather than explaining to my friend that Norma wasn't my real mama, I just kept smiling and sipped on my delicious tea. A few days later, I went to school and Norma introduced me as her daughter. At first, I thought people would look at me strangely. Norma was white and I was not. But no one stared strangely. In fact, teachers nodded and said, "It's nice to meet you." For the first time in a long time, I felt as though I belonged to a family. Norma was my mother, and the Chinese kids were my siblings. Although no one would understand, I felt as though I belonged to a family, which for me, it just felt right. And for the days and weeks to come, I integrated with what had become my new adopted family. This is a story that questions the meaning of family. I am a former foster and homeless youth, and I've also been adopted by a whole bunch of families. And this has been the theme of my life between the ages of about 14 to 24. It has also been over a decade since this story has come to pass. And so I want to share with you all a few takeaways that I gather from my story. The first takeaway, I invite you all to interrogate and question social norms that drive everyday reality. It is only through questioning norms that we can effectively break down the norms that drive the barriers that entrap us. As a teenager and young adult, I felt social pressure to exist within the norm of what it meant to have a real or biological or legalized family. Throughout life, I got questions like, "Is that your real mom?" Or, "Is that your aunt on your mom or dad's side?" Or, "How are you all related?" Now, as a foster parent, I got questions and comments like, "Is that your child?" And, "That's not your child." The totality of my experience has led me to understand that family is what you make it. A family does not need to necessarily be legitimatized by the government through adoption or marriage for it to be a family. That doesn't mean that these things don't matter. They do matter because they reinforce the institution of family. But the critical point that I want to emphasize is that these family configurations are not superior to other non-conventional family arrangements. So we need to question the language you use. I don't say, for example, real mom. And when people ask me these questions, I do not participate and the reinforcement of these norms. And the real takeaway here is that I've reached a point where I understand that not everyone will understand family configurations that deviate from the norm. If you find yourself in a similar situation whereby your family does not reflect the norm, I want to emphasize that a family is what you make it, and you do not owe anyone an explanation. Obviously, I cannot end this episode without discussing race. Race and racism play a role in this podcast in many ways, but I want to center this conversation about race and racism in the context of being in a non-conventional family as a former homeless youth where I had to establish family outside of my biological family. I want to explore what this means against the backdrop of living in a society that adheres to white, Western, and colonial definitions of what a family is. This definition defines a person as family if the relation is a blood relation or if the relation is legitimatized by the state. This definition or societal understanding is obviously problematic for individuals who do not fit within this norm. This includes people like me, who experienced an informal adoption, meaning many people welcomed me into their home as family, even though we were not related legally or through blood. For example, people ask me questions such as, "Is that your aunt on your mom or dad's side?" as if a person can only be your aunt if they or your mom or dad's sister. Or one might say, "Is that your real mom?" which reinforced the idea that a biological mom is a real mom and anything that is outside of that is a fake mom. As a foster parent, I've had people say, "That's not your real child." What we are doing in all of these scenarios is that we are reinforcing these white, colonial, and Western notions of a family with our words. We are also contributing to the construction of this marginalized group. As a person who grew up in many different families, I have experienced exclusion and marginality through the everyday questions and comments that I get from people due to my non-conventional family background. The totality of my experiences has led me to interrogate the meaning of a family. Some 15 years later, I have come to embrace my definition of a family. I also recognize how dominant definitions of a family reflect white, Western, and colonial norms. They also reinforce the marginalization of people who come from diverse families that may not fit the dominant narrative, such as people in the foster care system, people who were legally and not legally adopted, and so forth. I would like to expound upon this conversation by illustrating how the dominant definition of a family has a meso and macro level impact. I'll use the example of bereavement policy. A bereavement policy is a policy that is put in place by private or public sector entities, providing students and employees with guidelines on how to take off of work due to a death in a family. My question is, how are we defining family in this policy? Is it based upon blood or legal relations? If yes, we have a perfect example where the exclusion of individuals who do not conform to these white, Western, and colonial definitions is scaled up to the next level because it's codified into policy. We are granting rights to individuals who have a family that reflect white, Western, and colonial norms. We are denying those same rights to individuals who do not have a family that reflect these dominant norms. I'll let that marinate because I know it's a lot to take in. Thank you all so much for listening to The Voice Podcast. Remember to join the Facebook page where you can stay abreast on future episodes. Until next time.